My name is Tom Pearson. I'm a geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Vancouver, Washington. And I work full-time in volcanic hazards work. We study volcanoes in the Cascades in the Pacific Northwest. And we also respond to volcanic crises in the U.S. and overseas. And so it's one way of getting a lot of experience over a relatively short time, because there are always volcanoes doing something somewhere in the world, which is kind of fun. The course today is Minerals, Rocks, and Geologic Time, the basics, which I hope will be a good introduction for the rest of the week. Those of you who came in late, I have some handouts here at the end of the table you might like to pick up, and also to let you know that there's no afternoon boat departing, so if you have to leave, you better get out there in 5 minutes, okay. Let me also, before I really get into the meat of things, talk about some books that I recommended for the 2 weeks I'm up here. Two of them are in the bookstore. One is called Agents of Chaos, and it's a book that's not too technically written. It's about volcanoes and earthquakes primarily, and how mountains get built. It'll really be the guts of what we discuss on the third lecture on Thursday, and it's quite readable, and gives lots of examples of some of these phenomena, such as the most recent big San Francisco earthquake. Next week, I'm going to be getting into, with some trepidation, the whole thing about evolution and creationism and the apparent conflict that there is between those two concepts. I'll also just say that I don't think there needs to be a conflict for Christians, but I've recently read a book that's just fascinating about how life evolved early in the Earth's history. It's called Wonderful Life by Stephen Jay Gould. It's not light reading, but if you stick with it, it really is a mind-broadening book for the whole concepts. And he points out that there were just the most bizarre animals that evolved very early in the Earth's history, which left no descendants, and the fossils of which have only recently been discovered. And these things are truly weird animals. And he's got sketches and drawings of what they would have looked like and everything, and it's fascinating. A couple others that are not in the bookstore, but are good ones. Here's another one by Stephen Harris, the guy who wrote The Agents of Chaos. It's called Fire Mountains of the West, and it's a bit more detail on all the volcanoes in the Northwest, from Mount Shasta in California up to Garibaldi in British Columbia. And then a scientist's view of the whole debate between evolution and creationism, and it's called Evolution and the Myth of Creationism, and I guess the title gives you an idea of where that author stands on the question. And also, if you're interested in geology in general, there are lots of really good general textbooks out for first year college classes, which are always available in used bookstores. And if this is a subject you're interested in just pursuing for fun, they're usually quite well written, and I'd recommend getting one of those. Okay, to today's topic. As I said, this is going to be kind of a review of high school chemistry for some of you. And I just want to hit the basics so that the concepts are hopefully understandable. We're not going to go into great detail. I'd like to do this. I'll kind of talk and maybe stop and ask questions along the way. If you have any questions, please just pipe in and ask them. We can kind of go with whichever direction you'd like to go. Let me start with the whole area of matter, atoms and elements. And this is a way we, as scientists, we classify what matter is. Elements are just the most fundamental material, fundamental substances that matter can be broken down into, and it's the most basic form that can be separated out by chemical means. In atomic reactors and accelerators, we can split atoms and break down things even more, but with just chemical processes, the basic building block is an element. Up to now, or at least as of 1983, and I don't remember hearing any more recent discoveries, there are 103 elements. But interestingly, only 9 of those 103 elements make up most of the Earth's crust. So we really aren't going to worry about most of them in terms of geology. Elements are made up of atoms, and those are the smallest building blocks of those elements. And each atom has the property of that element. I put in here a little example of how, to give you an idea of how small atoms really are. In one cube of silver, which is an element, it has 58, and I don't even know what you would call it, 58 times 10 to the 21, or 58 followed by 21 zeros. That's the number of atoms in a one cubic centimeter of silver. And if that were to be flattened and spread over the whole surface of the Earth, that layer would still be 10,000 atoms thick. That's to just give you an idea of how tiny these things are. And it's only very recently that the most powerful special electron microscopes have been able to actually see atoms. We now can see what atoms look like. Basically, they look like little fuzzy balls under these special microscopes. No, they're not, and that's a good question. They vary greatly in the question was, are all atoms the same size? And they're not. Some atoms are very tiny, and some atoms are huge and very dense. And this next point in the outline, we talk about atomic number. That's the number of protons in the nucleus of the atom. And if the element with one proton is hydrogen, and that's the smallest. And so as you go up in atomic number, you get more protons and then some neutrons added in, and so the atoms get bigger and heavier. Isotopes, that's a term you hear from time to time in the newspaper. Isotopes are just variations of elements. It's like a mutation of a particular element. And what's different about an isotope is that it has one or more excess neutrons. Now, in the nucleus of the atom, we have the protons, which have a positive charge, electrical charge. The neutrons, as the name implies, are neutral, no charge. And then that nucleus is surrounded by a more diffuse cloud of negative charge we call electrons. We used to sort of think of them as little particles spinning around, but it seems to be a cloud is a more apt analogy these days. And then ions is another, sorry.
Yeah. By that, do you mean that they're not actually orbiting?
Well, they may be, but it's a problem of actually seeing or identifying where they are at any given time. They're sort of so fast or either our concept isn't quite right, that's probably not exactly what's happening. But we're getting right down to that limit of theory and what we can detect, and then the methods we use to detect things kind of start interfering with the actual processes that are going on, and so it's still kind of a gray area.
Do you have the same number of electrons orbiting, like hydrogen would have one electron?
Right, we still think of them as having a one electron or a, okay. Yeah. We still use that concept in terms of the formulating the negative charge on the atoms. Yeah. And then ions, another term that you hear from time to time, are simply elements that are imbalanced in terms of charge. They either have an excess of positive charge or an excess of negative charge. And we use, and that's a handy concept because ions will react with other ions. of the opposite charge to form, to come together and form compounds. And cations are simply ions with a plus charge, and anions are simply ions with a negative charge. Some ions are involve more than one atom, and these are pretty important in minerals. A real important one is the silica anion, and I actually have a misprint I need to correct for you. It's under complex ions, it's SiO4, not SiO2, to the minus 4 charge. And that is, I'll get to that in a minute, but that is really our basic building block of most of the minerals in the Earth's crust. But there are others. The carbonate ion, which is in limestone and marble and chalk, it's and Tums thinks it's calcium carbonate. Okay, calcium carbonate is one type of carbonate. There are others. And then the sulfate, the SO4, sulfur and oxygen anion, is a real common in minerals too. And those have real strong bonds holding them together, and then they come together with other cations in looser bonds holding them together. And of course, bonds are the kind of the chemical glue or the atomic glue that holds these different groups of atoms together. You see there the list of all the common elements in the Earth's crust, and by far and away, oxygen and silicon are the two most common ones. Together, they form about 72% of the elements in the Earth's crust. Kind of a staggering imbalance, given all the other variety that we have in elements in the crust. And then those are followed by aluminum and iron and calcium and so on, magnesium, sodium, potassium, and titanium. And the percentages on that list are their abundances in the crust. It is. It's a very minor element. It would be much less than 1% in terms of abundance. And I'll talk a bit. Talk in a minute about how some of these more rare elements get concentrated. Okay, so a compound, a chemical compound, is some grouping of these elements in an electrically stable way. So we have the plus charges are balancing the minus charges. And the most common one we have around here is hydrogen and oxygen. That's water. H2O. Hydrogen has a plus charge, so it takes two of those hydrogen atoms to balance the minus 2 charge, a negative 2 charge on the oxygen atom. And so that is a stable compound because it doesn't have any excess charges, either positive or negative. But under normal circumstances, water is a solid. Technically, we could call it a mineral because under some conditions, it does form a solid crystalline form, ice. But normally, we think of minerals as crystalline solids. Chemical compounds that form crystalline solids at normal conditions on the Earth's surface. And that's simply what minerals are. Now, not all minerals are compounds. Some minerals are pure elements. Silver, gold are two. Diamond is one. Diamond is pure carbon. And diamond also is an interesting thing because that's one form of two crystalline structures that carbon can form. Another crystalline form of pure carbon is graphite, very different material. And it's simply the way the atoms are arranged in their crystalline structure that gives those two minerals such a drastically different properties. The diamond is a packing of the atoms that's much tighter together, and the bonds are much harder. In fact, they're the toughest bonds we have. It makes it the hardest, most durable mineral in the world. There are over 2,000 different minerals in the crust. Many of them are very rare. I'm not a guy who goes out and looks for different minerals, so I don't know much about all these rare ones. If you're a mineralogist or a gemologist, you probably know a heck of a lot more about these than I do. in terms of the basic minerals that form the rocks in the crust, there are only several dozen, really, that are really common. And we'll see those and talk about those when we go out and look at them. Since oxygen and silicon make up most of the elements in the crust, silicate minerals are the most common minerals. And the silicate minerals are made from complex anion that we talked about just a minute ago of silicon and oxygen. And to conceptualize that, imagine three tennis balls in your hands or sitting on a table. Push them together so they're all touching and you form kind of a triangle with those three balls. Okay, then you take a large marble, put it in the middle in the little indentation, then put a fourth tennis ball on top so you have like a three-sided pyramid. That's a model of the silicate anion. You've got four oxygens and one silicon in the center. They're really bonded very tightly together, and that's the basic building block. Now, how these little pyramids of silica, as we call it, how these are arranged together make up the different families of the main rock-forming minerals. There are two families that have single isolated tetrahedra or pyramids. And these are the olivine family and the garnet family. Garnet, you probably know, as it's kind of a ruby red mineral, and that's how they are formed. And then they have other elements kind of packing in the spaces around these isolated tetrahedra that make up the rest of the glue holding them together. There's a lot of magnesium and iron and a bunch of other elements as well. If these little pyramids form chains, either single chains or double chains, and they do this by actually sharing oxygens. So rather than having a -4 charge, they'll combine oxygens where they meet and share oxygens, and then each one will only have a -2 charge. But they form these chains, long chains. Single chains are the pyroxene family, and that's listed on there. Pyroxenes, and then the double chains are amphiboles. Now those are names and terms you don't run across very often, but they're very common minerals. And here's a piece of a diorite from around here, and we'll talk about these kinds of rocks in a minute, but the black mineral visible in these and also in granite and lots of other rocks we commonly see, these are amphiboles, and maybe a few pyroxenes as well.
How is that
spelled? It's on your sheets. It's amphibole. The next most complex way we can arrange these little pyramids of silica is in sheets. So that instead of, it's like putting a bunch of chains together. So we have a two-dimensional arrangement that kind of goes off in all directions where all these pyramids are sharing oxygens and forming these sheets. And this is the mica clay group, another very common family of minerals. And these minerals form sandwiches in nature. That you have the sheet where most of the charge imbalance is taken up with between all of the little pyramids of silica. And so there's not too much surface charge on these sheets. So the sheets are held together with fairly weak bonds. And some pretty big atoms then can come in and fill the spaces in between. Commonly sodium and calcium, magnesium, iron, are some of the elements which will fill in the filling of the sandwich. And then you'll have another sheet of silica, and then another layer of filling, and another sheet of silica, and so on. And you can get different combinations of these. And the way, the number of slices of bread, so to speak, to the amount of filling, and the variety of the filling determines what the different minerals are. And clays are very much like micas, only micas are bigger crystals, and we can see those. Common micas are muscovite and biotite, and we'll see. I have some examples up here. At the end of the hour, we can look at those. And they're common in the rocks that we see outdoors. And then finally, we can arrange these silica tetrahedra in a three-dimensional network. That's really the most stable way, the most tightly packed way we can fit them together. And the minerals that form this way are quartz, which is real common, and feldspar. Now, feldspar is a family of minerals we don't hear much about, but it's really the most common mineral family in the crust. 60% of the crust is made up of feldspar. And it is, the feldspars are primarily the white, light-colored minerals in rock like this, diorite or granodiorite, granite, such as this. Quartz only has silica and oxygen. Feldspar gets a few stray aluminum atoms substituting for the silica atoms. And it makes it a bit more unstable structure because the aluminum atoms are bigger than the silicon atoms. And so it doesn't quite pack together quite as nicely as it would with the little small silicons. Quartz, by the way, though, has the lowest melting temperature. So it's actually the easiest to melt of all these minerals. And it's how society discovered that we can make glass, because glass in the windows is nothing but silica, the same little tetrahedra that are grouped together. The big difference between quartz and glass, in fact, the only difference between quartz and glass, is that quartz forms slowly and allows these little pyramids to pack together in the most optimal way, whereas glass is cooled quickly in the quenching process, and the little tetrahedra don't have a chance to line up correctly. So their bonds, they're much more spread out spatially, so their bonds aren't as strong, and so consequently you can break glass much more easily than you can quartz. Quartz is very hard. Yeah?
When it comes to recycling glass, then, does it break down much as, I mean, in a different time period, but in a similar fashion to quartz?
It will. Again, because it's not as tightly packed together, given enough time, it would dissolve and weather in the environment. But it would take a long time to do that. The differences in color in glass, for example, are just minute amounts of other cations that are added to the glass to give it the color. Okay, let me sort of move on from that. Each mineral has its own kind of comfort zone, a stability field. Because they form at different temperatures and pressures in the Earth's crust, where they're most comfortable is the temperature at which they form. And the intricacies of their chemical reactions and bonds together are very dependent on those conditions of temperature and pressure. So, for example, the black minerals, these amphiboles and pyroxenes, which are ones we call ferromagnesians, form at high temperature. They crystallize at high temperature, and therefore they are some of the first to weather out. If we leave this out for thousands of years at the surface, it will be the black minerals which will weather more readily than the white minerals. At least some of the white minerals. And this can be visualized if we have a graph with temperature on the vertical axis, and up around the highest crystallizing temperatures is about 1150 degrees, and this is centigrade or Celsius. We have the minerals of olivine starting to crystallize. If we started, for example, with a pure melt from deep in the crust, we call it magma, and as we cool it down, it starts even hotter than this. As it starts to cool down, olivine will be the first of the dark, these are the iron-rich minerals, the ferromagnesians. That'll be the first one to crystallize out. And then in the feldspars, there's some feldspars that will actually start to crystallize out too. And these are called plagioclase. And it's the calcium-rich ones will start to crystallize out. And then there's a whole sequence. We'll get the pyroxenes and the amphiboles. And then an iron-rich mica, biotite. And then finally, we run out of the iron-rich minerals. And these plagioclases are crystallizing also. And they become progressively richer in sodium. We call sodium by the symbol Na. The old Latin term was natrium. So that's where that comes from. And then we end up with minerals that are rich in silica still. We have potassium feldspars, which K is a symbol for potassium. We have potassium micas, which are muscovite. And then we have quartz. And then those are the last ones to crystallize out. So if we start with a magma, deep in the crust, we let it cool slowly, there will be a sequence of crystals forming at different times within this stuff. And then finally, at the very end, we're left with mostly kind of a mush of crystals with just a little bit of liquid quartz, a little bit of liquid feldspar, potassium feldspar, and a little bit of liquid mica, or at least the atoms left that would make these minerals. It's not, they aren't minerals yet. Also left in this mix are all the other big sloppy atoms that don't fit into the crystal structures of these other elements, like gold, copper, tin, zinc, lead, all the common ore minerals or metals are left. And so it's in the last stages of crystallization that these things are concentrated. And so it's just at the last minute, and that's how they come to be associated with quartz and quartz veins. That's what old prospectors used to go out and look for quartz veins, because they knew that's where the gold was, because they're all in those last stages of crystallization. And so and that's why we have copper here in Copper Mountain. At one point in the history of this mountain, there was a concentration through this crystallization process. Yeah?
The quartz streaks you see through the mountain, white streaks,
yes.
Is that from crystallization or is that from seeping in later and forming?
It can be both. It can be both because it could be the last stages of crystallization, and the high pressure that this stuff is still under can inject quartz into cracks, and so we have a quartz vein. But we also, quartz can also dissolve and be transported. Agates and geodes, which have, you know, beautiful quartz crystals in them, are made from this remobilized and transported and then precipitated quartz through the action of groundwater. So those don't form from the actual cooling of the magma. So if we combine these minerals together then in rocks, rocks are simply groupings of minerals that form in some stable way at a particular temperature and pressure. It can be deep in the earth at very high temperatures and pressures, or it can be right at the earth's surface, such as clays. Clays are a mineral group that form and are most comfortable right at the surface of the Earth. And in fact, when rocks weather, we go from a very hard, say this is a diorite, very hard, to something that's the same rock that's been sitting out a bit longer, and it has kind of a rusty color and is very crumbly. I can tell you just by doing this, the crystals fall apart. That's because weathering process.
Point up to the mountains and say, oh, that part there is all
just
rotten rock. Yeah. Is that what you're talking
exactly.
about?
Exactly. It's like being rotten. But really, a more technical term is that it's weathering that's going on, weathering processes, that and these minerals are recrystallizing.
Is there any rational reason why copper happens to be in this area and not in another area?
Well, there is. And I have to say that I don't know enough about the geology of this area particularly to be able to give you a good answer on that. But there would be, somebody probably has studied that and has figured out why it's concentrated right here. We have three basic families of rocks then. We have the igneous rocks, which are the ones that form from cooling of magmas. And these can be volcanic or plutonic. Volcanic rocks crystallize quickly at the surface because volcanoes throw the stuff out onto the surface. And so because it cools quickly, the crystals are very small. And so typically volcanic rocks have small crystals. Sometimes they have big crystals floating in a mass of smaller crystals, such as this one. You can look at this a bit closer at the end, but it has big white crystals surrounded by a ground mass. We call it a very, very small dark crystals. The white crystals would have already crystallized, you know, early on, like I said. And so some of this crystallization is going on. And then at some point, maybe about here, after some crystals had formed, it decides to erupt as a volcano. And the rest of it all crystallizes very quickly and gives us the small crystals. So those are the two basic types. And on Wednesday, we'll go out and look at some of these as they actually occur right here in the area.
What plutonic? Go ahead.
Yeah, I can.
This is the volcanic type of rock.
As you look at them, it's the crystal size.
Yeah, but the volcanoes are skewed out. What about plutonic? They just sort of cool from the surface down?
Well, the plutonic rocks are rocks that the magma never got to the surface. It got up partway up into the crust,
yeah,
and then stopped, yeah, and then cooled there in place over thousands and thousands of years. And so the atoms had enough time to really organize themselves well, and they form really big crystals. Right, we do. We see it because these occur in mountain ranges. This is the guts of the mountain range, and erosion has been occurring here for millions of years. It's stripped away the volcanic rocks that were originally up higher, and we see it's the core of the mountain. Now, in mountain ranges, there is tremendous pressure and temperature that continues for a long, long time. And we'll talk more about this in the third lecture, but temperature and pressure changes to minerals, as I said, with the weathering, will cause minerals to recrystallize. And if there's been enough recrystallization occurring in a rock, it changes. And so we move into another family of rock called metamorphic rocks, which simply means changed. So they started out as one type of rock and then got changed through temperature pressure differences, either higher or lower, and it has recrystallized into a metamorphic rock. And the common types of those metamorphic rocks that we see around here are called schist and gneiss. Those are kind of weird names. Those are German names. They have weird spellings. Those are listed on the page 2. And they make up the core, again, sort of the core of the mountain range right here where we are in Holden. And we'll see some of those on our nature walk next time. And then as these mountains erode, weathering processes break the rock down, physical processes transport it, wind and rain, freezing and thawing break up the rock, break it down into sand-sized grains and even down to clay-sized grains. The rain and the streams wash it then out to the ocean eventually. The rock accumulate, or these sand and clay grains accumulate in very thick piles, and then a change occurs there. The heavy weights of all this material will eventually cement these into a type of rock we call sedimentary rocks. And the cycle is complete when those sedimentary rocks become so compacted and then transported by the plate tectonics process we'll talk about again in lecture three. And they'll be turned into metamorphic rocks again. So really, we can talk about a rock cycle. And all of these rocks have been through probably many cycles in the Earth's history. The gneisses and the schists that we have here in the Cascades, for example, here are some. I'll pass these around. These are rocks which started out as sedimentary rocks. We know that because some of the layers in between them are marble. And marble forms from limestone. It's a metamorphic form of limestone. And in some cases, they can even find very distorted fossils in some of these schist rocks. But they've really greatly been recrystallized. Okay, and then finally, to put this all in context of time, geologic time is something that, again, we read about from time to time in the popular press or in books, but I want to give you a concept of how incredibly long we believe, the scientists believe, the Earth has been around, and how old some of these rocks really are. On page 3 of your handout, there is a chart which has all the terminology of the names of these different epochs in the Earth's history. They're kind of tongue-twister names, but geologists do use the names in column 2, in the subdivisions of geologic time, to categorize the ages. And then in the middle of that chart, you see radiometric dates. So those are the approximate boundaries in terms of millions of years ago, when these different times were. And then in the last two columns, you can see some of the events in the Earth's history that are associated with those times. And for example, at 63 million years ago, that's the end of the Cretaceous period. Fascinating time, because it was a time of tremendous extinction of different forms of life on the Earth. Dinosaurs were the most widely known variety of animals that died out at that time, but there were also all kinds of other plants and animals, fishes and plankton and all kinds of things that just disappeared from the Earth. And there's a controversy raging right now in scientific circles as to what exactly caused that extinction of life over much of the Earth. Not everything, obviously, died out, because there is life here today that has gone on. But the main hypothesis right now, and it's still being attacked vigorously by, from many quarters, is that a tremendous asteroid hit the Earth at that time, probably many miles in diameter, that caused a huge, huge explosion and threw up so much material and dust into the atmosphere that the Earth was dark from this dust for probably years. And so plants would have died, and not completely dark, because some survived again, but the effect probably went on for years. And then there are places in the strata, in the Earth's layers, that you can go and you can put your finger right at that point in time in sedimentary rocks, And I've been to one of these places, and you see one type of limestone, and then you see a layer that's only about a half an inch thick, and it's black. And it's made up of ash and particles of different material from totally different sources. And then after that one half inch of black material, then there's limestone again. And limestone forms from little plankton, but the plankton that form the new limestone are a different variety, at least in abundance. So apparently one variety of plankton or several varieties were able to survive this, whatever it was that caused this, and the others died out.
On this time scale,
yes.
When was the breakup of the continents and the drift started, and that sort of thing in this time zone here?
Well, there have been many breakups and many comings together, so there's not really one time.
Well, they one of the things they say was all one continent.
Yeah, Pangaea.
Pangaea, whatever they call it. And then it started apart, and that's the reason they had so many dinosaurs in all these different places and commonality. About what, any idea on the scale when that was?
Yeah, I think in that second to last column on the right, there's the beginning of the Atlantic Ocean. At around between 210 and 255 million years ago.
Okay.
That is somewhere around in there. That's when this thing started to break up and the split between Africa and South America and Europe and North America was going on. And that was one of the main breakup times.
Okay, thank you. That's a general idea.
Mm-hmm.
Just a question.
Yeah.
I have a question. You said you've seen area of the rock in this different strata. Where was that?
That locality was in Italy. Near the town of Gubbio, okay. In central Italy.
From what I have read, one of the theories on the huge meteor striking Europe was that it would have been down in the Caribbean area.
That's one of the sites. Yes, actually, kind of right on the edge of the west side of the Caribbean in the Yucatan area in Mexico.
And the influence of it would have been so great that it affected the whole world.
Yes. Yeah. But there's some people that still they say that all the evidence doesn't jive with this theory, and so it's still being argued a lot today. Now this time scale has some pretty big numbers, but I want to give you an idea conceptually of how long these times really are, and let me try that in two ways in our remaining minutes here. Let's start with a timeline. If you're a visual, sort of distance-oriented sort of person, let's have an imaginary timeline, and we'll start it right here in front of me, and we'll put the scale of this timeline at 1 inch equals 5,000 years, which is basically the length of recorded human history. Go back into the ancient writings of the ancient world in the Near East. About 5,000 years, 1 inch. Okay, if we go back to human-type animals, hominids on the Earth, in terms of the dates we have for the earliest fossils, that goes back about 4 million years. And that would move us 67 feet down the road on our timeline. If we go back to when the dinosaurs became extinct at 63 million years ago, we've gone 2/10 of a mile back down the road. So if you think of this in terms of little, 5,000-year increments, that's getting us down there a ways. If we go back to the time when land plants and animals first appeared on the Earth, before that it was just marine animals and plants, that would take us 1.4 miles down the road. And then finally, if we go back to the birth of the Earth, as best we can date it, at about 4.7 billion years, now I'm shifting from millions to billions, that would take us 14.8 miles down the road. Then, the other way to look at it is to compress are 4.6 or 4.7 billion years into a single year of time. And let me just read how this has been done in a textbook. On that scale, the oldest rocks we know date from about mid-March. Okay, we're starting in January, okay? Oldest rocks, mid-March. Living things first appeared in the sea in May. Land plants and animals emerged in late November. And widespread swamps that form the Pennsylvania coal deposits flourished about 4 days in early December. Dinosaurs became dominant in mid-December, but disappeared on the 26th, at about the time the Rocky Mountains were first uplifted. Man-like creatures appeared sometime during the evening of December 31st. And the most recent continental ice sheets began to recede from the Great Lakes area and from Northern Europe about 1 minute and 15 seconds before midnight on the 31st. Rome ruled the Western world for 5 seconds, from 1159.45 to 1159.50. Columbus discovered America 3 seconds before midnight, and the science of geology was born with the writings of James Hutton with slightly more than 1 second before the end of our eventful year. So I'll end there with the official part of this, and we have a 5 or 6 minutes in our hour. If you want to stick around and ask some questions, we can do it as a group, or if you want to just break up and come up and look at some of the rocks I have here too, we can do that. Do you have any questions now, as we're still in a group?
Do we use or do we import crystals now?
Import crystals?
Yeah. During World War II, we used to import them from South America.
Yeah, well, the crystals that are, well, the industrial supplies of minerals, as well as crystals that are used for collectors and that sort of thing, come from all over the world, yeah.
Well, this was the most important place at that time. I remember when I worked for the West Electric Company, and they used to import those. Because they were the clearest, I guess, they weren't.
The crystal for radio?
Yeah.
Okay, that would be quartz. Quartz crystals were used for radios, yes, and there were some good localities around here for that. But also there's excellent quartz localities in Brazil, for example, and lots of places in the world. Quartz is a pretty common mineral.
Don't they make them now?
Oh, they do. That's right. We don't rely on natural quartz anymore for, yeah, and for silicon wafers and the whole computer industry now depends on synthetic quartz, which is manufactured by mostly Japanese companies. And a lot of them actually here in the Northwest. We have several of them right in Vancouver, Washington, where I live. And it's manufactured there. Yeah.
Do you have an idea of generally how old the rocks are that we see just here in this valley?
They range over quite a range. The youngest rocks are about 22 million years old, and those are the Cloudy Pass batholith. That's a big mass of plutonic rock up at the head of the valley. The rocks that we're sitting on right here, the schists and gneisses here, are about 220 million years old. I should back up a little about your question with quartz. Quartz was used in radios and is used in the computer industry because it has a peculiar property that is pretty unusual, and that is if you compress it or stress it, it will generate an electrical charge, an electrical current. It has what's called a piezoelectric effect.
I'm wondering back on the first page, mm-hmm. What is the significance of isotopes occur naturally?
They do, and they can be created in atomic accelerators as well.
So, you will have an isotope then that is similar to an element?
It's just a form of the element. Let's for example take carbon. Now, carbon normally has an atomic number of 6, has atomic weight of 12 normally, so it has 6 protons and 6 neutrons. There are two isotopes, common isotopes, carbon-13 and carbon-14. Carbon-13 is a stable isotope. It's pretty happy just with that extra neutron. It doesn't get too bent out of shape with that attached to it. Carbon-14 is not stable. It's radioactive. In fact, I didn't mention that before. Radioactivity is produced from the decay or the breakup of these unstable isotopes. When they break up, or break down, I should say break down, they break down back down to usually to their original form or to another stable form. Carbon-14 does not decay back down to carbon-12. It decays down to nitrogen-14, which is a stable form. And what they go to depends on the way, the mechanism that this breakdown occurs. They can release gamma rays of energy, or I should back up and say when an event occurs of breaking down, there's a tremendous release of energy. And that's how atom bombs form. They have concentrated all these unstable isotopes, plutonium concentrate in one place, and then they artificially cause all of them to decay back to their stable form at the same time. In natural radioactive decay, this is occurring just continuously, and so it doesn't really affect us because it's so diffuse and dispersed in the world. But in a bomb, it's all forced to occur at one time, and this tremendous release of energy is what makes atom bombs so powerful. So when, for example, when carbon-14 decays, it's giving off electrons. And these electrons can actually be counted if we put the unstable element in a counter, kind of like a Geiger counter. And if we count the rate at which these are occurring, or the number of little blips that occur in the counter, it tells us how much carbon is in there, how much carbon-14 is in there. And we use this concept to actually date the age of material. So if we know how much carbon is there totally, we know what proportion occurs in nature of the unstable and the stable carbon. By counting how much of these little radioactive blips are occurring, we know how much carbon-14 is in there relative to how much carbon-12, and that helps us. The proportion then tells us the age at which this carbon was fixed in a piece of charcoal, for example. And we use that as a geologic clock to date. In fact, that's how these numbers have been assigned to the geologic time scale for giving the age of all different periods in the Earth's history. For carbon, it does. It has to be organic. But there are other unstable isotopes that occur. Potassium, for example, has an unstable form, potassium-40, and that decays to argon-40. And again, a similar procedure of measuring ratios of one to the other lets us date rocks that are much older, because the rate at which potassium decays is much slower than the rate at which carbon-14 decays. Yeah.
Would you say that the carbon-14 use of carbon dating is a theory or a fact?
That's a good question. Virtually everything we know in science really is theory, because that's the way science works. We try to explain things, how something works, scientists, over a long period of time. And every other scientist that comes along will examine that and see whether they think that's right. And scientists mostly tend to be a pretty egotistical bunch. And we get a lot of feedback, positive feedback, if we can disprove somebody else's theory. So scientists are forever trying to disprove what somebody else has theorized. And so it's still in the theory realm, because nobody has been able to disprove it. Every measurement we've been able to make on these unstable elements indicates that they decay at a very constant rate. All sorts of
that's probably pretty close to a fact, is the rate of decay.
Yeah.
What sounded, I don't really know anything about it, but it sounded to me as if perhaps the area of weakness of the theory might have to do with the proportions of the carbon 14 to the carbon as a whole.
And originally, when you go back, how much carbon 14 was there around 10 million years ago?
Well, it has changed, and one whole branch of the research of this has been in figuring out how that original ratio of carbon 14 to carbon 12 changes. Carbon 14 is made by cosmic radiation in carbon dioxide ions that are floating around up in the upper atmosphere. And then they kind of drift down to here, where they're taken up by plants in photosynthesis and then fixed in the cells in those proportions. And it's actually been found that there are cycles and the proportion changes with time. So we have refined carbon 14 dating a lot by going back to those original cycles of proportions, and we use that information then to calibrate the dates we get. So we're pretty good, I think, at and also these dates have been tested using tree ring dates, for example. And we know that the carbon 14 dates we get, there's always a plus or minus. There's some experimental error in these measurements. But the carbon 14 ages we get for things back, say, 1,000 years ago, have been verified by tree ring dates, where we actually count the rings in trees, in single trees that are even living today. There are species of pines, bristlecone pines, that live in the mountains of the Southwest. That lived to be 2,000-3,000 years old. So we can get these records of tree rings going all the way back, and then we can actually extract, and that's how some of this calibration was done, they extract the wood from those single rings of trees, so it was in that year the carbon was fixed, and so we can measure the proportions from that.
Without killing the tree?
That's right, we can do it, you can do it by taking a core.
But the one thing you got to remember in all this stuff is that the old thing, was you there, Charlie?
Yeah.
No one was there, so
that's right.
We had to pick theories.
That's right. The theories have to be a good explanation, and then they have to withstand the test of time and other scientists trying to disprove them, come up with other evidence. And theories do change.
Is that one of the differences then between evolutionists and creationists?
Oh, yeah.
As far as the dating?
That's right. The creationists have explanations that to counter. They don't believe, for example, that these rates of radioactive decay have been constant through time. And they have arguments to try to argue that. But in my mind, every serious look at their arguments has been able to disprove them. If they come up with one which we can't disprove, then we'll have to sort of reconsider. It's the same with evolution. Evolution has fit all the evidence that scientists have been able to come up with so far fits very well with evolution, and so the scientists believe it's a good theory. It may change. Up until the late 60s, there was a theory about how mountains formed that was totally thrown out in 1968, 1969, when new evidence came to light that came up with this whole idea of plate tectonics and seafloor spreading. It totally turned the science of geology upside down. And we'll talk a little about that in lecture 3. But it's a really good example of how science works. It's always kind of working to try to find the best explanation.
Are you talking